problem on the freeway this morning, and we're having a bit of a problem getting people in here.
There's a problem on the freeway?
Again?
Blocked the freeway at exit 260B. Everybody exits there single file and find their way through the back roads into the Capitol.
Hmm.
Yeah, overturned semi at Market Street somewhere along there.
Okay.
We're going to begin with House Bill 3241 and invite
Mr. Green from PUC, Greg Green.
Greg Green from PUC.
Greg Green from
DEQ.
Pardon me, I thought that was my alphabet mixed up.
Are you testifying on that bill?
Okay.
Thank you. Roger Hamilton. Sorry about that.
He was wondering why the DEQ was going to testify on his bill.
I bet.
Oh, yeah. Maybe some new stuff for people.
Do you want to talk about the
Chairman, members of the committee, I'm...
Am I on here?
Roger Hamilton from the Public Utility Commission.
Thank you.
The commission unfortunately finds itself opposed to a engrossed House Bill 3241. Affiliated interest oversight is really in some respects at the core of what we do. It's needed because utilities can otherwise increase profits if their affiliate charges excessive amounts for services it provides to the regulated utility. In addition, affiliates can gain an unfair competitive advantage and impede competitive entry when they're subsidized by the regulated utility. For example, to have the utility provide free or even below market value customer referrals to its affiliate would be anti-competitive. And the transaction levels are significant. In 1997, total affiliated interest expenses on an Oregon interstate basis for GTE and U.S. West telephone utilities were $66.2 million and $31 million, respectively. That's a substantial percentage, particularly in the case of a GTE of their interstate revenues. The Senate has agreed this anti-competitive concern is significant, witnessed in Senate Bill 1149, which is the electricity restructuring bill, where there are provisions that prohibit cross-subsidization between competitive and regulated operations. We could support raising the threshold limit to $100,000. This is the current limit is $25,000. It's an old limit, and just applying inflation, you get partway to $100,000, as long as the reporting requirement on an annual basis is not eliminated. As the bill now reads, a utility can divide a $150,000 contract into two $75,000 contracts, and the commission would probably never know if an abuse had taken place. The annual reporting requirement will help ensure this abuse does not take place, as well as provide other important and new information to the commission. It's not simply a rehash of information already provided to the utilities. When the commission reviews and approves affiliated interest contracts, what we are approving is essentially a bounds on the nature and level of activity. It's kind of a good fences make good neighbors, and I think it's really helpful for both sides to understand what's going on. The affiliate interest process is comparable to going to an auto repair shop. The filing of the application would correspond to getting the estimate and details of the labor and parts to be provided, but the annual report would be the final bill covering the services actually provided in the total cost. In this case, with the $100,000 limit, at least we would like to know what the total bill is. The other change that we would recommend to avoid some confusion between this statute and our general powers would be to place a period at the on line 3 of the bill. I'm sorry, on page, it's inserted after 75.9.39 on page 3.
Line 4, right?
It's my page 3. Section 3, the filing of proposed contracts under ORS 759.385 and 759.390 shall constitute a telecommunications utility's role, sole reporting obligation under ORS 759.985 and 759.390. We'd suggest a period and then a deletion of the rest of that, which would eliminate any confusion because we do have commission authority to review affiliate interest transactions pursuant to other kinds of investigations, such as a rate review filed under other statutes. And with that, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'd be glad to answer any questions or call on staff if I can't answer the questions.
So that's the amendment we're talking about in terms of reporting, right?
That is not. The reporting amendment...
Where's that? I don't understand where the reporting reference is.
Right.
I see that. So...
Let me...
$100,000 is in there, so you support that. Right?
Right. Section 3... If that, okay, let me let Mark Kelman from my staff explain this. The reporting obligation that we would retain, as I understand it, would that change, we would still have the reporting.
Mark Kelman of staff at Commission. The amendment that Commissioner Hamilton mentioned about putting a period at 759.390 is merely taking the bill as it stands, how to avoid legal battles over what this act does. It doesn't change the intent of the bill. The position that our annual reporting requirements, or if we went to every 2 years for reporting requirements, that should not be eliminated. That's what the first two sentences of Section 3 do. And so if you were to adopt the Commission proposal of continuing to allow us to enforce affiliated interest protections for customers, then you would delete Section 3 entirely.
Okay.
The opponents of the measure suggest that this gives you an opportunity yet to review these transfers twice instead of three times. If the bill stands as it presently is drafted. Why is that a problem?
Chair, sir, we would have the ability to review in a rate review, but it would be quite cumbersome. And basically, we would have to go back without the ability to approve the transaction or disapprove it. We would have to go back. It would be a fait accompli. We would have to go back in the rate review and possibly seek a refund. I'm going to have to tell you that, quite frankly, as I look at the record between $25,000 and $200,000 transactions, there really aren't very many. So it has not been a burdensome requirement for either the PUC or, as I can see it, the utilities. And, of course, they obviously have a different opinion. There was one in 1998 for GTE Northwest, one for U.S. West, three in 1997, and one in 1996, and none so far in 1999 for anyone. But we're just concerned about the cumbersome nature of, okay, we have a fait accompli. There was an abuse. Now we have to go back and fix it in a rate case, and meanwhile customers are are disadvantaged.
It appears that with so few cases, raising this limit then doesn't present a serious problem to customers.
What I have said is in a sense, a double-edged sword. It's not a serious problem, but it's not a serious problem for utilities either. And I guess it's the principle. If there is abuse or the potential for abuse, then our ability to review these transactions is obviously a deterrent. We don't know what the consequences are when you have deterrent regulation to lifting something and finding that, therefore, that you've opened up the door to potential abuse.
Any further questions? Thank you very much. Invite Shelley Jensen.
Good morning. I'm Shelley Jensen, Regulatory and Governmental Affairs Manager for GTE, and I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 3241. I want to briefly explain how the process works today. Today, the limit is $25,000. When we do a contract with an affiliate, within 90 days of executing that contract, if it's $25,000 or above, we need to file it with the Public Utilities Commission. They currently have an expedited process for $25,000 to $100,000 contracts, where those contracts are deemed approved unless they notify us that they want to look into it in more detail. $100,000, above $100,000 contracts are they are required to investigate from under the statute. Now, how much investigation they do is up to them. And then if they find that the expenditures are fair and reasonable, those expenditures can be included in a rate proceeding. If they find that the expenditures are not fair and reasonable, then they are not supposed to include those expenditures. None of that changes. All this bill says at this point is take the expedited process away and say you don't have to file anything under $100,000, but it doesn't change the looking at the fair and reasonableness of the $100,000 contract. There also is in the rules a requirement that we file an annual report. That's why this section that eliminates the report is kind of confusing, because the report is actually in the rules, not in the statute. And this was, in talking with Ledge Council, this is what they drafted in terms of what they felt was appropriate, Section 3, to eliminate the requirement for the annual report. The annual report then reports not only all the contracts that we filed, but it also requires an organization chart of each of our affiliates, a list of the common directors of each affiliate, a description of each affiliate, a balance sheet and income statement for each affiliate, and a report of all the transactions, which is a contract that we've already filed with them. So that's the second time that we report on all these items. And then when either we go in for a rate adjustment or the PUC has us come in for a rate adjustment, they can look at all of the contracts again, including ones that were under $100,000 if this version of the bill were to pass. They can't adjust our rate until it's in a rate proceeding. So even though we would file these annual reports, all they can do is look at the information. They don't at that time go back and make any adjustments based on these contracts. That still waits until a rate proceeding. So our position is they look at the contracts when we file them, determine whether they're fair and reasonable, and then when we go in, either we go in for a rate proceeding or they bring us in for a rate proceeding, they have the opportunity to look at it in detail again, and so that there really isn't a compelling reason for us to be filing these annual reports in the interim. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair, what was the reason for the statute in the first place?
We're not quarreling with the statute. I mean, I think that there is a genuine concern on behalf of the PUC and of consumers that there should be some oversight of affiliate transactions, and the idea behind it is that there's the possibility that we may be giving some advantage to an affiliate of ours in terms of purchasing from them, that if we went to competitive bid or something, it may be a different result. But this does not do away with the filing of the contracts, nor the PUC's ability to look at our contracts in any kind of a rate proceeding.
Well, the reason for my question was I don't understand what the other reporting requirements you have, why the statute is passed in the first place.
The reporting requirement is in the rules, the PUC's rules. It basically, I have a copy of that here, and it basically just says we'll file an annual report of affiliate transactions on a form prescribed by the PUC. And so, and then they have asked for all these other...
Was the rule in existence prior to the statute being adopted?
I don't believe so. I think it's based on the statute.
Other questions?
Any further questions? We any other witness that desires to testify on 3241? If not, we close public hearing and we'll hold a work session on House Bill 3241.
Mr. Chair,
there's some dash, there's some amendments here. What are these amendments all about?
I believe they just changed the annual reporting time to a calendar year.
What it does, I'm Shelley Jensen for the record, Regulatory and Governmental Affairs Manager for GTE. We had, the version that passed the House, we had assumed meant we only would file contracts that were over $100,000, and the day of the hearing on the bill in the House, we received a Attorney General's opinion that had been sent to U.S. West that basically said their interpretation of the statute was that once you hit that $25,000 threshold, then you have to file every contract because it's an annual amount. So, it literally says, and I have copies of this for the committee if you'd like copies. It literally says in here if you have a contract for $25,000, you hit the threshold. So if you have a subsequent contract for a dollar, you have to file that contract. And we were just talking with the PUC this morning. I don't think any of the rest of us had interpreted the statute as meaning that. So we're trying to eliminate the annual threshold so that it basically says if you have a transaction that's $100,000, you file it, not if you have annual transactions at $100,000.
Do you also support these amendments?
I think so. No?
Okay.
You don't support them. Okay.
I'm sorry, I was mistaken then.
Chairman, members of the committee, actually haven't seen CCG's opinion. We would not interpret it that way. I can understand Ms. Jensen's concern if she thought that we would.
No, I.
But we would not, and again, eliminating the reporting requirement, the annual reporting requirement would be a concern to us.
This doesn't eliminate the annual reporting requirement. That's the section that's already in there. This basically eliminates the language that he says because it says annual transactions of $25,000 or more. Just says, changes it to transactions of $100,000 or more, and we've got the annual portion of it. And it wasn't our interpretation that you would ever
know this,
but we were concerned once we saw this sitting out there that then it could come back and sort of undo what we had tried to do here in terms of saying once you had reached $100,000, then you have to file every contract. Sort of ours and Ledge Council's attempt to fix this issue.
And our interpretation would be, and therefore this will not be needed to be fixed, would be that the additional dollar would have to not be a different contract, would be related to the same contract. I just don't understand why he would ever construe it that way. I'm really not prepared to say that we support or oppose those particular amendments.
Sure. Did you testify before the House Committee on this?
Chairman, I testified on a third-party bill, but not on this one specifically. But we certainly didn't testify on these amendments.
Did you testify on question three of both areas?
I did not. Mark, do you?
Good.
Mark Tellman of Commission staff again. We testified in opposition to eliminating the annual reporting requirement.
In the House?
Yes.
For the Connecticut Inspection Service, you testified that you would support 100,000 if you wanted Section 3 eliminated.
Yes, or to go to reports every 2 years, but not to eliminate the reporting requirements so that we could track and get the information that these abuses aren't occurring.
Did you offer an amendment?
I don't believe we did.
And you're opposed to amendments to your reporting. I'm sorry, you're opposed to those.
No, we're in support of the bill.
Well, I'm having trouble here. Maybe somebody understands what's going on. I'm trying to figure out whether or not you guys can get together on the bill. You can't.
No, we tried. And the sticking point is the annual report.
We have talked with GTE. Excuse me, Chair. We have talked with GTE about the bill and about this change in Section 3 and about the annual reporting requirements, but we were not able to reach agreement.
Again, as Senator Courtney, you understand that we would support the bill raising the limit, the threshold to 100,000, as long as the annual reporting requirement is retained.
Sure.
Senator Barr.
Trying to make sure I understand this. The system in place now has them asking approval of any contract over $25,000?
Senator Barr, Chairman, yes. So, and again, on an expedited process where within 90 days, if you don't act, the application is automatically approved. So that is the case.
And then you have an annual reporting requirement in addition?
That's correct. Yeah. And we have found, and I can't speak, Senator Byers, to whether the annual reporting requirement itself has discovered these, but we have returned to consumers millions of dollars of this way of interest transaction abuses. And I'm not speaking directly here to GTE or to any particular company.
So this is,
we found it very useful.
What this proposal would do then would remove the requirement that the companies file anything under $100,000 with the PSC. Additionally, it would remove the requirement for an annual report.
Yes, Senator Byer, that's my understanding of the line.
Does that leave the PSC with no knowledge of transactions under $100,000? Is that the effect?
Well, not until there's a general rate review, which in the case of GTE, has been recent, but before then there was quite a span of time. I don't know, 6 or 7 years.
I don't know. Before my time. Shelley Jensen, and just as an example, in our rate review that we just had, we reduced rates $25,000. Less than $200,000 of that was because of affiliate transaction issues. So it's not, at least in the recent times, it hasn't been a significant amount of money.
So, Commissioner,
$25 million.
If you get the reports, I guess what can you do with them? What effectively can the PUC do with them?
Senator Barr, Mr. Chairman, we would then have to use this information when there was a general rate review or initiate a rate review on the basis of this information if we found it fairly serious on our own initiative. And I'd just like to reiterate that I think the reporting requirement acts as a deterrent, and it's very difficult for me to be able to ascertain or to guarantee that this reporting requirement does or does not eliminate abuse. But I think clearly if it's there, there's less likely to be abuse than if it's not there.
Another question?
From my cost you're giving in the aggregate, it seems like the dollar amount we're talking about is rather insignificant for a rate review case.
Senator Beyer, I've got a... These are mostly real estate contracts and data processing types of services that are provided by affiliates. As I said before, that between 25 and 100,000, there have been, well, in 1997, year before last, GT had three, so I'm assuming that that would total up to, could potentially total up to 300,000, but perhaps did not. That would be 75,000 to 300,000. They have not been insignificant with respect to some other very notorious cases that I can remember, in the case of a rental agreement with U.S. West leasing space. I guess it's the principle and the fact that there are dollars here, significant dollars, if you have these abuses. And I can't tell you how many of these abuses we would have if we didn't have the reporting requirement. Because we've had it.
That's 22, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it seems the end game is that the only thing you could do as the PUC would be to initiate a rate review. And the impression I have from discussions this year over all these telecommunications things is that rate reviews don't happen very frequently.
Senator Beyer, they don't happen very frequently, nor do we want them to happen very frequently, because they're expensive for both sides.
Everybody.
Jensen would agree with that.
So your sense is this is a deterrent. I can't imagine that it does a whole lot. Having these reports, other than taking up linear file space, not sure if it does anything. I understand your role as an attorney for the public interest.
Appreciate that, Senator. Thank you.
Any further questions? Senator DeBar.
Shelley, since you're the proposer of this, do you need, I can understand there are two issues that are here. One is the filing of the reports, and the other one is the prior approval of contracts. Why do you need both?
I don't think we do.
Why do you need to be eliminated from both? It strikes me that if the real issue is you don't want to have prior approval.
No, it's not. It's actually not prior approval. It's we file it and they have 90 days to look at it. And I don't think, and maybe you folks could answer this, I don't think they actually disapprove the contract. I think the most that happens is that they would say if it was something that they didn't think was fair and reasonable, that amount couldn't be included as part of our rate base. But I don't think you would void the contract in that. And that's my sense.
Sure. The commission, in fact, if found that the terms were not reasonable, would not approve the contract. Staff would recommend changes to the contract such that it would be in the interest, and a lot of times we work that out with the utilities to make those changes.
But I think ultimately if we decided to continue on with the original agreement, what would happen is that you would simply say this can't be included in customers' rates rather than saying that we couldn't continue with the contract. Does that sound right?
No, it was actually done.
I mean, I can't imagine somebody saying we're going to continue on anyway, but...
Mr. Chairman, it is my recollection, and Senator Byrne, my recollection that we have disapproved contracts.
Okay.
On the basis of the filing.
Right, right.
Senator Byrne,
I'm trying to be clear on that. I guess the point that I'm trying to get to is will the PUC, prior to opening a rate case, still have a reporting, an aggregate reporting on an annual basis of the contracts?
No.
because we're eliminating both the submittal for approval as well as the annual reporting?
You're only eliminating the submittal for approval of $100,000 and less. Anything that's $100,000 or more, we submit, they investigate and decide whether it's fair and reasonable.
Okay. You spoke to the annual reporting under administrative rule. Do we do anything to remove that?
Yes. That's what Section 3 in the A and Growth version does is that's what led counsel drafted to eliminate the reporting requirement because the reporting requirement is actually in the rules, not in the statute. So.
So this is doing two things.
Right.
Section 3 speaks to the annual report.
Correct.
And the balance of it speaks to the reporting.
It just speaks to raising the amount from $25,000 to
$100,000. Senator Beyer, Mr. Chairman, under the way the bill is currently written as this draft reads, we would not see, we would have no idea what was going on until there was a general review.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Barr.
I guess I have no real problem with the notion of bumping the prior approval up to 100,000. Those smaller ones strike me as not significant. But I do think that the PUC probably in the regulatory role has a need to have this information on an aggregate basis. On an annual basis, so I guess I'm troubled with Section 3.
Senator Barr, they actually get copies of the contracts. So what the annual report does is we're required to file an organization chart for all of our affiliates, balance sheet and income statement for all of our affiliates, a description of what businesses they're in, a list of directors of the affiliates, and then we also file a list of the contracts which for the most part, our contracts that we have already filed with the PUC because they're 100,000.
Where is the requirement that there's a filing of the contracts?
That's currently in the statute.
So regardless of the dollar amount, you have to file the contract?
If it's what we're changing now, the way the statute is today, if the contract is $25,000 or higher, we have to file it. Now we're changing it to over $100,000, we have to file it. That's in sections basically 1 and 2 of the current version.
Yeah, I guess I'm still not clear is, let me go to the bottom line.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm saying is you have to provide, in my mind, the PUC needs to know what your contracts are to mm-hmm. be regulatory sense. And if you're telling me that by approving the bill, we take out their approval authority, I don't have a problem with that, but I do have a problem with them not being notified of your contracts, whether they do that once a year in a report or if you just submit the contracts to them, they don't have to approve them. I think they have to have regulatory, they have to have that information.
Right now, let's assume that the 100,000, it bumps up to 100,000 and we'll talk about the 25,000 today. What this would do is any contract that was over 100,000 within 90 days of execution is filed with the PUC and they have the opportunity to investigate it and either decide it's fair and reasonable or decide that it's not. Currently, we also then annually file a report which includes a list of all the contracts that we have filed with the PUC. Mm-hmm. And so what we're trying to do is eliminate the report, but we would continue to file all the contracts that were 100,000 and above, and then also when it came to a rate case, the PUC can come in and look at any of the
contracts. You would not file those that were under 100,000.
Correct.
And that's my issue.
Okay. Okay. Well, now we don't file things that are under 25,000. And between 25 and 100,000, they're deemed approved unless the PUC tells us they're not. So it's a little bit, it's an expedited process. And
I understand that.
Okay.
We're short members. We're in the subcommittee of the Rules and Elections Committee, and we're going to adjourn this work session. We can't be in work session with subcommittee. Now, we're going to move the Senate Bill 855. public hearing. Invite Keith Claycomb. Let's see. Yeah. We need to, I'll reverse that. We need to start with opponents here. Joe Willis, Terry Sandblast, and
for the record, Mr. Chair, Joe Willis, I'm an attorney with Holly Williamson and Wyatt, and worked on this on behalf of AK Media, a client. This started out as a task force effort, but I think it's probably fair to say at this point the task force aspect of that fell away. The reason this bill is before you is the chapter 377, in my opinion, is probably unconstitutional, at least under our state constitution. There's a pending appeal that's been argued and submitted to the Oregon Supreme Court, which has been under advice for many months now, I think it's 8 or 9 months. That could be decided at any time. And it's an unusual case because the lower court who dealt with it, the Court of Appeals, really did not address the state constitutional issues. I don't want to seem presumptuous, but any of the lawyers that I've discussed this with around the state that do a good bit of this work, as I do, are in agreement that there are very, very significant problems, and it's highly likely that the Oregon Supreme Court will probably do something with that. There's one caveat. The record in the case was quite unusual, and the Court of Appeals who addressed it technically said, well, you didn't raise any of these issues different than the federal First Amendment, so we don't apply any different analysis. There may be some way for the court to sort of duck the issue. I doubt it, frankly, but I can't speak for that court. But I think it's highly likely that sometime in the next several months, the Oregon Supreme Court is going to declare major portions, at least, of that act unconstitutional. The industry, and particularly my client AK Media, thought it appropriate to try to fix this before that happens. So there is, in my mind, an effort to do a constitutional fix to make sure you can hold on to reasonable regulation and yet do it in a lawful constitutional manner. That meant that these definitional sections of the Act had to have attention to get rid of content-based controls. And that's the key under the state constitution. We've at least tried to do that. And bear in mind, this came out of a task force effort in the beginning with different inputs from different people. I put some language in there trying to force the notions of anybody would read this to look at the historical and functional basis of these signs, not just what the message says. Because traditionally, the Act was passed back in 1971 before the Oregon constitutional analysis that now pertained began to be developed in 1982. So the rules have changed on constitutionality very significantly since this Act was passed. Nobody that passed it would have had any way to foresee that, I don't believe. So it's time to do it. It needed to be done, and irrespective of what the Oregon Supreme Court does with this case, if this case doesn't do it, there will be other cases. Somebody will challenge that and make an appropriate record, and a judge will have to, in fact, I believe, declare it unconstitutional. So it needs to be fixed now. And obviously, the risk, if it should happen while the legislature is not in session, and if FHWA decided to try to impose a holdback of the 10% of the federal highway funds, which they can do before it comes out of compliance under the Lady Bird Act, that is a huge amount of money. I think it's about $30 million for biennium now with 10% of the figures. So it's a huge risk. So we commend that to you to do it now. And at the same time you're doing it, the industry has looked at it. It's been 28 years without any significant amendments of substance, aside from this constitutional problem that was created. There are three significant aspects of that we believe should be receive attention at this time. And those have to do with, one, the definitional sections of visibility. The way the thing is now it's very difficult to determine what is visible from the highway in question that triggers the controls. And the best example I could give anybody, if you've ever driven on I-5 through Portland heading to the north near the new Rose Garden, there's a split section of street above you. There's a sign, which if you're in the passenger side of the automobile, you can get your head out of the window, crook your neck, and you can barely see that sign as you go by at freeway speed. Some people have taken the view that sign is visible from that freeway, and so it's subject to regulation. I frankly believe that result is clearly preposterous. So we've tried to do this so that we say that now the sign has to be primarily viewed from that highway, so it's a much more practical, common-sense, usable definition, and get out of those type of silly arguments over, you know, can you bend your neck or hang upside down and possibly see it, and make it a functional, workable tool. The other aspect of it was to try to capture some notions of technology. Currently, the statute would not allow what we refer to as tri-vision signs. These are signs that have a triangular-type blade that sticks into the frame, mechanically rotated on an interval that has been accepted by the FHWA as a safe and appropriate way to do it. Over 30-some other states approve this. The state of Washington has it. It gives the industry the ability to become more efficient, use the technology, maximize the communicative ability of these structures, and yet not required to add additional structures into the environment or create a problem with a new and different structure. So you get whatever impact of that structure sitting there, you just have the ability to communicate through it without any further additional problems or difficulties, which we commend to you as something that's eminently good sense and time to do it and bring Oregon into conformity with the vast majority of other states. The last point was, on those amendments on the detail, was dealing with the definition of interchanges. That's been changed to make it much more reasonable and workable. And because of the current definition of interchanges, there are examples, particularly in the eastern side of the state, where frontage roads dealt with part of the interchanges. You can have interchanges that are multiple miles long. And so you have an off-ramp at one point down onto a frontage road, goes well along the road for miles and miles and miles, and comes back on. And under current definitions, that's considered an interchange. And so you have all of these blocked-out rules that hurts people when they try to have a sign that is needed and needed badly for their businesses and what they're trying to communicate, just because of that artificial nature of what's occurring. The definition we've submitted would take care of that and make it much more functional and usable. So those are the main items, and I would be happy to answer any questions. And then Mr. Sandblast here, who is from the industry and our lawyer, chime in too if there's any information that we can also give you.
Mr. Chairman? My name is Terry Sandblast, and I'm a governmental affairs manager for AK Media Northwest, and have had the privilege to be the Oregon Outdoor Advertising Association's president for approximately 5 years now. Mr. Willis has recapitulated a lot of the issues and the legal issues. I don't want to belabor that. He's noted some of the technical issues. The Oregon Borders Information Act, adopted in 1971, has worked well for 28 years, darn near 3 decades. And in that point in time, we've only, as industry, looked at and identified just a handful of technical concerns. Over the years, there's been approximately 500 signs removed from the state highways and are currently within what we call the state bank. It's not likely that those signs would be ever utilized in a great number. Due to the statewide planning efforts that have been gone on since 1973 and urbanized development within our communities and the zoning that goes along with that. The technology that Mr. Willis talked about is the TriVision technology. Is very kind of low-tech. It is not the television-type sign that you may have read about or perhaps seen on I-5 as you go north into the Tacoma Fife area, the big one that's up there. We're looking at the technology that provides for the maximum use of our utility, which is the structures that are there. The other kind of changes that we're proponents for are creating an alternative to the requirement for certification documents like nature by local government. It's our opinion as industry operators that
that if we obtain a permit from the local government that allows a sign to be constructed, then if we provide that permit or a copy of that permit to the state to acquire our state permit, that should be sufficient documentation. The certification requirement is in the regulations presently because the regulations were adopted in 1971 as part of the requirement prior to land use planning. So now all of the state has been zoned, all of the state has been planned, and we think that the local jurisdiction permit, which allows us to build it in that jurisdiction, should be sufficient for the state purposes of certification. So we've suggested that there be an alternative, not throwing out the requirement for a certification document, but providing for an alternative, which is a provision of the copy of the permit. We also are suggesting that the current state permit life of 120 days be extended to 180 days, which would make it consistent with most building permit requirements for building permits. The association, looked at the fee structure that's within the OMIA, and we looked at that, and it's 28 years old. We suggested that the fees be increased. So we suggested doubling those fees, and that's what we proposed to do. There's also one other aspect of this, and there's an amendment to provide for stronger penalties for those folks that violate the tenets of the OMIA. And I'd be glad to answer any questions that you may have regarding these things.
Any questions? Senator Barr.
Thank you. Can you direct me to a point in, I guess we're looking at the -2 amendments. This is the gotten stuff, right?
If I understand.
This is the bill. Where is the conflict that you were addressing, the certificate for permitting business between local government and state?
It's under Section 4, it's on page 8. Section 4 requires the submission of an affidavit, and we've added a second point there with an or, leaving everything that's in the regulations as it is today, and inserted an or to a copy of the city or county sign permit.
And Senator, I would add to that a little bit of history that I've had occasion as a lawyer where I've had a city jurisdiction that clearly had no basis not to sign the state affidavit form. That's promulgated by the state. But the state doesn't have any compulsory power to make a city sign it or step in and help the sign owner. But I've had occasions where a city, admittedly, having no basis not to sign it, just says, hey, there's nothing in our codes that make us sign it. So, nice talking to you, go away, and we had to actually sue them, and in a mandamus in the circuit court, the judge was very harsh with them. In fact, I think he, my recollection, he even posed sanctions on them for that. But there was just this silly void that let some people take that position when everything else is perfectly lawful. This would take care of that and deal directly with the state on the requirements that it's met these code provisions, because if you don't meet the code provisions, you won't get a permit, and that's clear proof that you have done everything properly at the local level.
It's been a long time since I dealt with sign codes. I think the last one was back probably 15 years ago when I was in the city planning commission. We did my city sign ordinance. The city ordinances, sign ordinances, have to be in compliance along state highways with state law.
They must. Yes. Chapter 377 requires cities to alter. There are some provisions in there that are imposed that they also must do some certain things because they have preempted certain things.
So we can assume then that ODOT would be following on city ordinances to make sure as those are adopted or reviewed that they are in compliance?
I don't believe that ODOT does any review procedures for compliance, but what ODOT insists is on this affidavit that currently exists is that they comply with all the requirements of the city ordinances.
You could have a situation where you might meet the general requirements for placement of a sign that would meet the state requirements but would not meet the city requirements.
That's theoretically possible now, yes. If you violated the city code, if you wanted to build a sign in violation of the city code and it was along one of these control corridors that ODOT controls, then you would not get anybody to sign the affidavit because it would be in violation. But likewise, I think a better proof that it is not in violation is the fact the city has issued you the permit. If you don't have to make a second trip to the counter to find the official, to get the affidavit signed, and fund the money to do that. You have the permit in hand that is itself proof positive that you have complied with the local code.
You're making it, I mean, you're doing the assumption. You shouldn't have to go through two processes.
Sure.
If you get the one from the city, then you ought to be in compliance with the state.
I can think of no better indication of compliance with the city code provision for a sign than having a sign permit issued by the city administrators who administer those codes. So I don't think you should have to go back and get a separate affidavit signed by them that if you have that permit issued that says the same thing.
And you still have to get a permit from both?
Yes.
Mr. Chair?
You're back.
Joe, are you testified in favor of the Dash 2 amendment?
Yes.
I'm sorry, I was called to another committee meeting. That's a very important amendment.
Yes.
Thank you. I know this well. We've tried a case.
All right.
No further questions? We've got other opponents of the measure, Ted Buse.
Mr. Chairman, I don't like to be redundant, and I would be, so I just wanted to register.
All right.
Outdoor systems advertising and also favors the Dash 2 amendment.
Thank you kindly. We call Al Leitner from ODOT. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Al Leitner. I'm with the Oregon Department of Transportation Right-of-Way Project Administration. The Oregon Outdoor Advertising Sign Program is in my unit, and I'm here to speak to what the bill with the Dash 2 amendments would do to that program. Very briefly, they would subject Oregon to a forfeiture of between $25 and $30 million per year from federal highway funds for violating the agreement that we have with Federal Highway Administration. The amendments would allow three full billboard messages to appear in rotating fashion, the tri-vision, where one stationary message appears today. That raises some safety issues of distraction to motorists, which is a concern to us. The Dash 2 amendments will allow billboards to be situated or constructed in such manners to be visible to several different highways in high traffic areas, where today they must meet specific spacing requirements on each highway. The Dash 2 amendments will also relax other spacing requirements for billboards along freeway interchanges and will allow billboards to appear where they don't appear today. And there will also be, under the Dash 2 amendment, other technical changes to the existing statutes that will allow billboards to be installed where you don't see them today. To speak specifically to some of the issues that were raised, the unconstitutional aspects of the Oregon Outdoor Motorist Information Act may be in question. However, there's varying opinions on just what might be the issue, what might the Supreme Court find. There are a lot of opinions and there's a lot of guessing going on. And as was brought out in earlier testimony, U.S. District Court has found that the Oregon Act is not unconstitutional. U.S. District Court of Appeals has not found that it's unconstitutional. The Oregon Court of Appeals has not found it to be unconstitutional. If the Oregon Supreme Court finds it to be unconstitutional, the question is what part? Probably not the whole act. It seems that it would be speculation at this point to take a stab at it and hope we get it right, when in fact we could get it wrong and just compound our problems.
a bad guess that really worked to our disadvantage at this point. Other parts of the Act that are affected, the change in definition of visibility, the introduction of moving or rotating signs, redefining what an interchange is, those are all fundamental shifts in Oregon's policy on how Oregon wants to have outdoor advertising displayed. The Oregon Transportation Commission and Federal Highway Administration entered into an agreement years ago about which direction Oregon wanted to go. The more appropriate course for these changes and these major shifts in policy would be for these ideas to be brought to the Transportation Commission, have them investigate more fully the issues at hand, the safety aspects, and put it through that process prior to bringing it to this level. And I would recommend that that be done rather than this approach. I'm almost done.
Okay.
Just a couple very quick things. I agree that the Act has worked well over the years. I have not gotten any approval from Federal Highway. This would be okay with them, even though other states may. The Federal Highway in Oregon has not. In summary, the bill attempts to fix the current statute without knowing really what ought to be fixed or what might need to be fixed, if anything. And it would definitely shift Oregon's outdoor advertising program significantly. Any questions? I'd be happy to answer them.
Any questions? Senator Bryan. I have a series of questions. One, I presume what the Federal Highway Commission would do is if they found that Oregon was out of compliance, they would send a letter, and it begins a series of then discussions. And so any loss of funding is not usually immediate. Is that correct?
Chair Starr, Senator Bryant, that would very likely be true.
And in my dealings with other state agencies on issues where for some reason Oregon's been out of compliance, this has probably been in the research area. The federal agency also recognizes the fact that when we're not in session, unless we have a special session, the legislature can't address things in a legislative way. And so I mention this to the committee because I would like to believe, especially with our two U.S. senators and congressmen, that we wouldn't immediately lose any federal funding. Secondly, it's my understanding that the Court of Appeals decision was accepted by the Supreme Court on a writ of review and that the case has been briefed and argued, and that took place some time ago. We've been waiting for a decision for how long?
Chair Starr, Senator Bryant, for some reason November pops into mind, but that's a guess.
And there's no deadline on when a Supreme Court has to give a decision. If the Supreme Court ruled that a portion or all of the current statute is unconstitutional, and I think they're going to do something, because one, they obviously wanted to hear it because they accepted the writ of review, and secondly, if you look at their decisions over the past few years dealing with free speech, Oregon has a broader free speech constitutional provision than even the federal government. I'd be surprised if there wasn't something that was done. But let's say they threw out the entire statute. What kind of pickle would the state of Oregon be in then, especially as it relates to the federal legislation?
Chair Starr, Senator Bryant, I don't know what kind of pickle that would be.
Could we be in jeopardy on our 10% of the federal highway money?
Chair Starr, Senator Bryant, yes, I believe we would definitely be. And my conversations with Federal Highway is that they won't go slowly on this. They have found reason to be upset with us from time to time on this program and our compliance with it. So I don't
I think we would have to be fighting with Federal Highway rather vigorously at some point.
One final question. Has the federal government accepted what the DASH 2 amendment proposed with any other states?
Chair Starr, Senator Bryant, Federal Highway is different in each state, and different states have different agreements. The agreement in Oregon is different than any other agreement that any other state had or has. The Federal Highway Administration for Georgia can decide something. It has no bearing on what the Federal Highway Administration does. Ours is totally independent, and what they've decided and what Oregon has decided was the pact that was made. And they have expressed to me they're not seeing in the DASH 2 amendments things that are encouraging to that agreement. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
What part of the amendments allow for more signs to go up? Section.
Chair Starr, Senator Courtney, if I can get my hands on a copy. Okay, under the change in definition, page 2, line 28, change in definition of interchange. Right now we know what an interchange is. It's how an interchange was designed. We can get out the design plans and say it's
part what?
Page 2. Line 28.
Thank you.
By changing the definition of an interchange, you can now say, well, that leg of the interchange isn't an interchange part anymore, so we can put a sign up there. So you'll see signs going up around legs of certain interchanges. Not all, but some.
Mm-hmm. And where does it allow for these really burly lines?
Okay, that would be in change of definition, page 5. Line 31, where it then introduces the definition of tri-vision and as a sign.
I was given a summary of these amendments, and I faxed it down to the Deputy Attorney General, Dave Shulman, who I have immense respect for the constitutional order. He faxed me back home around the date yesterday. I think he meant the DASH 2 amendments. He looked at the DASH, he says one amendment to the bill, and also to Dave Burrell's description of the amendments. He wasn't sure which one he wanted me to review. But his determination is that the amendment in question changed some definitions, like on-premise signs and outdoor advertising signs, and make the OMIA more content neutral. Those amendments, or something very close to them, were drafted by DOJ, which is the Department of Justice Attorneys, who believe that they will remove some of the significant constitutional problems of existing OMIA, which is under challenge in the state and federal court. Other constitutional problems may remain. This particular statute involves the interplay between the OMIA, the Federal Highway Transportation Act, the U.S. Constitution, the Oregon Constitution. I talked to him after receiving this yesterday, and he felt pretty comfortable about 2 and 3 in these amendments. Now, we didn't talk about these other things you brought up, but he felt pretty comfortable with sections 2 and 3 in terms of this current on-premise time thing. It might help from a constitutional standpoint in terms of how the court's going to rule. Do you object to sections 2 and 3?
Chair Starr, Senator Courtney, I don't object to an attempt to try to address specifically and limited only to what is felt to be the constitutional infirmity. I do object to adding all sorts of other things that cause other problems.
That's what I was going to say, because I'm caught here now, because I thought I had this thing all resolved, and he wanted to particularly mention Dave Jones, mentioned Bryant, myself, wanted to look at this because of the lawyers, and so I really would like to... For me, you wrote some up some roadblocks about this, all other stuff, but I was focusing on the constitutional sections, and I thought 2 and 3, and the Deputy Attorney General, well, I, as I say, maybe Neil won't agree with me. I don't think he's a goofus. I do think he knows a little bit about constitutional
law. No, I think he's one of the best in the state in constitutional
law. So I'm really pleased that he moved so quickly. This was all done yesterday, and I realize this isn't part of the record. It's not being made part of the record, and it's just helpful to me that I feel comfortable with 2 and 3 and what they tried to do here. I'm now nervous about some other things that you're raising, to be very frank with you, and so I'm just sort of working and discussing. I am sharing online. I had no idea where the members of the state were going to go, but so thank you for your testimony.
Mr. Chair. Senator Bart. Senator Courtney is going to, what I was trying to do, is trying to separate out in an analysis form here which are the issues that need to be taken care of to address the constitutional issues, the First Amendment issues, and which ones are really new policy choices. I would suggest that perhaps the interchange definition and the tri-vision signs are different issues. Not that they're bad issues, but they're a different kind of an issue that we may want to deal with or we may not. And again, it would be helpful to me, Mr. Chair, it would be helpful to me if we could have a staff analysis perhaps about it, just kind of separating out and telling us what the impact, the letter that Mr. Lightner gave us was interesting, but it doesn't help me understand what the amendment is doing technically in the kind of the section by section, and it would be more helpful if I knew what your concerns were as they relate to the amendment so that we can deal with that if there are issues that we need to consider.
I think it would be helpful too to have Mr. Schuman come.
Yeah.
And once we get that analysis and him walking us through it, I imagine he's very familiar with the litigation and the field that's pending in front of the Supreme Court.
My limited experience in dealing with sign codes is they're not easy to deal with. And there's not kind of a slap it down and you're done.
Well, I was asked by the lobbyists to look at the inspections. It appears to me there's construction. Actually, I guess the developer funds are okay in terms of helping us with the constitutional funds. But there's some other things that I've heard that I've heard. You know, but I'll have copies of turbines that may give me of this, and also maybe I think it's a good idea to have Mr. Schuman come here. He was very familiar with the case. We discussed that this was the oral arguments and everything else and how he thinks it might go.
Appreciate that. We have one other witness. Keith Eichel.
Chair, at 9:30, we'll go to another meeting. It should only take about 15 minutes. I don't know what time we go to session.
We're supposed to go to caucus.
9:45.
Caucus. Right. So we'll be starting at 9:45.
Mr. Chairman, member of the committee, I'm Keith Claycomb. On behalf of the Oregon Roadside Council here, testifying against the proposal. I might mention, this has been a very elusive bill to come before anybody to talk about. We started out under the Transportation Committee, and it was scheduled to be on, and then it was off. And then we came, and then through the business, time ran out when we were supposed to testify, and it was postponed a week, and then it disappeared, and then it comes to surface yesterday. And so if I seem disjointed, it is, because I haven't been able to catch the darn thing. And I also apologize if I do not seem to answer your questions promptly, because in my hurry to get into that traffic jam north of town, I left my hearing aid home. So with that, I'll try and do the best I can. I thank you. This Senate bill appears very innocuous. It has some things in there that we like. That is, with the constitutional issue, there's no doubt about it. But we ask you to use caution when thinking about this bill, because I understand it, just, from what little I know, it can be a kind of a glutton stuff thing. Once it's opened, everything can happen to it. And it has been referred to the Supreme Court, what would happen if with the Supreme Court on their ruling, whether it's constitutional or not, and how you would address that. Also, what the funds would be lost by the federal government. I have a summary of what I have here, and I've taken a liberty to change the date from April 27th in the Transportation Committee to this committee. It's the same memo. Facts haven't changed any. I just got a little older, I guess. But the thing I come down to ask you about going cautiously, I was a member, as another member, another Oregon Roadside Council person was, of a task force convened by the Justice Department under Paul Graham to study issues. And basically at the time, we thought it was going to be addressing to provide input for expediting adequate enforcement of sign regulations as now administered by the state of Oregon according to the code. So this task force met about three times last year in the fall and then in the first of the year. And at that time, we discussed these different issues. No consensus was reached. There were present Oregon Department of Transportation representatives, Justice Department representatives, the outdoor advertising representatives, Federal Highway Commission, Federal Highway Administration, I think it was John Whitman that was there, and then Oregon Roadside, fighting Goliath. But we met in the session to talk over these changes, and we could see some changes that could be made. But again, the constitutional issue was really the one that we met for, to prevent the illegal signs that are on the highway. Well, no vote was taken, no consensus was reached, and on a memo dated from Mr. Sandblast on November 11th, he proposed a different some changes, which are very similar to the ones now that's in this bill. We came in a month later, in December, that 11th said, well, if you're going to open it up, then we want to have these items considered. And with that, we met in January, and then the task force just kind of died of its own weight, I guess, or its own inaction. And that's why we ask you, please, to be very careful when you open this up, because we're not against signs. We're just against a visual pollution. We don't want moving signs. This is one thing we're adamantly against. For instance, I don't think people realize that if you're traveling at 60 miles an hour, in 1 second, you've gone four car lengths, that's 1,001, four car lengths for 88 feet. Well, if these signs are put in there, they're put there to attract your attention. If they attract your attention, then you're distracted from the road. I understand that the human mind has a great capacity to do a lot of things. I have seen a person on a cellular phone, behind the wheel, putting on lipstick and still driving. I don't know how it happens, but it can be done. I've seen it happen. But I think any distraction is a safety factor. And we ask you, please, if you do open this up, please stay the constitutional issues. Thank you.
Question? Thank you. Appreciate your testimony.
We are back in the subcommittee of the Committee on Rules and Elections, and cannot go to a work session, but we need some further work on this issue. I think that as proposed by our attorney members of the committee, we need that you get together with the Attorney General and perhaps with the ODOT, see if there are some provisions of this that we can agree on and develop a bill that works. We certainly are running short of time. We don't have a lot of time, committee time, to work a bill. So you're going to have to do a major part of the work outside of committee. With that, we're going to close public hearing on Senate Bill 855, and we will I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2637 and call Rick Holmbaum.
City of Scappoose.
Rick, we're courting you some courtesy here, having traveled so far.
My mayor is also here, and he is later on the list.
Would you invite him forward, please?
Charles, I just talked to the Legislative Council and to the Attorney General's office, and they think by next week they'd be able to come in and talk about two amendments in some detail. The bottom line was there may not be a way to have a constitutional text, one that complies with the right constitution and meets with the federal requirements. They may be able to have it long term, but that's the challenge.
Thank you.
It'd be good when they do that.
Good morning. For the record. Good morning, Senator Chair Starr, Rick Holmbaum, Interim City Manager for the City of Scappoose. Appreciate the courtesy since we did come travel to speak briefly on this particular House bill. My name is Rick Holmbaum. I am the Interim City Manager for Scappoose. After reviewing the City's file on the revision of the Portland Area Motor Vehicle Inspection and Maintenance Program boundary, I have come to understand some of the frustrations a small community of 4,855 persons are feeling about being included in the Portland Airshed. When Newburgh, Dundee, Aurora, and Markham were excluded from the DEQ testing program, the DEQ analysis stated that the removal represented 21,125 vehicles polluting the Portland Airshed. According to DEQ, these areas were exempted because of the hardship that the non-commuting population would have suffered and the unfairness of including them in the process. That same hardship continues to be imposed on the Scappoose residents. According to the 1990 census data, there are only 2,748 total commuters in the two Scappoose census tracts. Because a higher percentage of a smaller population commuted to the Portland Airshed, our residents were required to comply with the DEQ vehicle testing program, while other communities were exempted based on percentages. The hardship has continued to increase. When the DEQ initially required these inspections, there was an older inspection station located 15.8 miles south of Scappoose. That station has since closed. The nearest facility is now across Cornelius Pass in the Beaverton area. For some of our older residents, the trip to DEQ is the only reason they would ever consider driving Cornelius Pass. Now that another Scappoose exemption is before the legislature, we have heard rumors that the DEQ is discussing providing a limited portable testing station somewhere in the Scappoose area, but they want the city to provide the facility to house site equipment. We don't have an extra existing structure, and we don't have the funds available to provide such a structure, and we don't have anything in writing from DEQ. We support House Bill 2637 as a minimum in addressing a community that has patiently followed all the required processes for a very long time and has still not been provided with any relief. Thank you for your consideration. Do you have any written testimony for us?
Yes, I do, sir.
And I will give you some support.
Thank you.
Please. Good morning, Senator Starr.
Good morning.
My name is Glenn Dorschler, and I'm mayor of the city of Scappoose, Oregon. Since 1995, the residents of the city of Scappoose area have been testifying in public hearings, filing appeals, writing letters, paying for studies, and working with the DEQ and the legislature seeking relief for our community. Today is another step in that process. While the city of Scappoose supports efforts to protect the air quality, we would like those efforts to be combined to the vehicles actually contributing to the problem. House Bill 2637 would provide limited relief to the DEQ testing requirements by exempting our non-commuting population. This would benefit at least 1,292 of our citizens residing in the Scappoose area who work in Columbia County, as well as many retirees in our community. In 1997, the Oregon legislature approved a similar bill. Governor Kitzhaber, however, refused to sign the bill, but asked the state's Environmental Quality Commission to look at hardship and fairness issues relating to the testing problem. If changes or exemptions need to be made, Governor John Kitzhaber said he would support them wholeheartedly. After the veto, Scappoose City members were told by the DEQ staff that it would require action by the state legislature to provide relief for our community. So I'm here this morning, Senator Starr, at this legislature once again requesting that relief. I would ask that you would please help us to continue attempts to resolve this issue by supporting House Bill 2637. Thank you, sir.
The bill would exempt from the requirements of vehicle testing those certified by the owner not to be used to commute to work within the Portland Airshed.
Yes, sir.
Any further questions of the witness? If not, we thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
I appreciate that. I'm going to close public hearing for the moment on House Bill 2637 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3455 and by Jane Loken.
He did?
Yeah, let me see. Thank you, Senator, and members of the committee. I believe that you can take time to hear our bill, and I am Jane Loken from District 25, and I have with me my legislative assistant, Roberta Lesperance, who will introduce herself, but Roberta has come up with an idea that Representative Edwards and I feel is a very worthy one, and so that's what this that's why we're here to testify on behalf of House Bill 3455. For those of us in the metropolitan area and in Medford, we are required by the state to undergo an enhanced emission test by the administered by the DEQ every 2 years. This, of course, impacts all the motorists in the area, with all of their cars. What happens is that you find yourself involved in long waits at the DEQ station. And the stations are open on Mondays from 9 to 5 and Tuesdays and Fridays from 8 to 6 and Saturdays from 9 to 5. However, most of us work till at least 5, often after 5, and have other obligations on weekends, and so the hours are not really user-friendly for those who are working people. And I imagine this happens in the Medford area, too, where these tests are administered. So this bill is a move to accommodate at the stations in the Portland area, and I am hopeful also in the Medford area, motorists as they come in and avoid the hour to 2 hour, hour and a half wait. And often when you go through, you don't pass the first time, so motorists must come back another time and wait again. There are accommodations that DEQ has tried to make by having people call in and make some appointments, but it really does not alleviate that wait, and the problem is that if you're in a job that is a 9-to-5 or 8-to-5 job, difficult to get there at the time that the DEQ is open during the week. So that's what this is about, is to get longer working hours at the DEQ station, and we have worked with DEQ on this, and believe that it's a good common sense solution to helping the citizens of Oregon in the metro and Medford area.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning, Senator Starr and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Roberta Lesperance. I reside in Portland in House District 15, and my legislature is Representative Randall Edwards, and I am legislative aide to Representative Jane Loken from House District 25. And I'm indebted to Representative Edwards and Representative Loken for introducing this bill at my request, and I certainly thank you for giving this bill this important opportunity to be heard. House Bill 3455 directs the DEQ to establish a flexible operating schedule for the vehicle emissions testing program that is mandatory in all or part of 7 northern Oregon counties. They are Clackamas, Columbia, Jackson, Marion, Multnomah, Washington, and Yamhill. And then the representative has also made reference to the obligations for Southern Oregon as well. And as she indicated to you, currently the test stations are open on what might be termed banker's hours, and banker's hours no longer fit the way people live their lives. I asked Representative Edwards and Representative Loken to introduce this bill after my personal experience in January of this year when I had to get my car retested. I did everything DEQ said I should do. I went mid-month and I went early in the day. But because I was working out of the area, my only opportunity was to go on a Saturday. I got there about half an hour after the testing station opened, and already the line of cars was backed clear back out of the lot and back to the street. I sat in line with my engine on idle for an hour and 45 minutes before I got up to the front of the line. And what happens with the enhanced emissions test is you get up to the front of the line, you get out of your car, and you go in a little room and stand while they test your car. I went into the little room, and the man ahead of me said, "I work 6 days a week. We only have one car." He said, "When am I supposed to get this done?" And the man coming in behind me was equally frustrated. He said, "I've been waiting here for over an hour and a half." And when we did leave, the line of cars was longer than it was when I first got there. Now, the representative referred to the fact that you don't always pass the test the first time, and I'm living proof that that happened. So by the time I got my car adjusted so that it would pass the test, I had to take time out of a weekday in order to go through the test because I was running out of time. I got there an hour before the test station opened. There were already 9 cars in line ahead of me. So once they opened the test bays, I faced another 30-minute wait before my car was tested. And as I left at about 9:40, the line of cars went out the lot and down to the end of the block. Now, every morning, thousands and thousands of motorists, and every evening as well, pass within a few blocks of the DEQ vehicle emissions testing station, but it's either not yet open for the day or it's already shut down. And what this bill asks is that the schedule for it becomes far more user-friendly. And just let me quickly point out a few of the folks who could be benefited by flexible hours. First of all, those who live in an impacted county but work outside the area or vice versa could deal with the test during non-work hours rather than having to tie up a big chunk of a Saturday. The same holds true for small business owners and their employees who currently either have to deal with that Saturday or they've got to take productive hours out of the workday in order to get this test taken. And thirdly, those who commute to work via public transit. Right now, their only legitimate option is Saturday. And so I think this would benefit a number of different groups of people in the metro area. You will see in your packet that I just handed you a letter of endorsement from Associated Oregon Industries. Also, I can report that their representatives and also representatives of the OEA have agreed that if this bill becomes law, they will be happy to help convey the information about the new hours to their members. I think a lot of people will get behind this so that it can be successful because the public education piece of it is obviously very important. So thank you very much for giving this bill this opportunity and for giving us the chance to talk on its behalf.
Questions? Senator
Byers. Not living in the Tri-County area, I don't have any experience with what the testing stations are like. How many employees are generally there at a testing station?
Well, I think you have
Mr. Green here from DEQ, and he could probably answer that question better, but I think there are a number of bays at each station.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a slower test than it used to be. It used to be a much more simple test. The enhanced emission test has lengthened the time, and that's what's creating quite a block. It used to be, even then, when it was a simple test, you waited, but now it's magnified, mm-hmm. the problem, because of that. I might mention, too, that we have asked DEQ about using flex hours so that this will not have an impact, that they will, stagger the hours of their employees with some working early, some late, and it would not be every night of the week. And I think that the DEQ is working on a plan to make that happen, and I'm sure that DEQ representative here could respond to that. But as far as we can see, at this point, there should not be a fiscal impact.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're closed public hearing on House Bill 3455, and reopen public hearing on House Bill 2637, and write Representative Leslie Lewis and Senator Jerry George. And we are running out of time.
Okay. We'll be quick. Mr. Chair, committee members, I want to thank you very much for the opportunity to be here today to testify on House Bill 2637. For the record, I'm Leslie Lewis, and I'm the state representative in District 29. I need to give you a little background about why House Bill 2637 is before you today. In 1993, the legislature dealt with an ozone maintenance plan for the Portland metro area. They had to develop this plan, a 10-year plan, to show that they would stay in compliance with ozone levels in the Portland metro area. And a part of this plan was based on the fact that population would increase and that they needed to develop emission reduction strategies. You just heard about one of those strategies in the previous testimony, enhanced emissions testing. As part of the overall strategy, they did talk about expanding the vehicle emissions testing into Yamhill and Columbia counties. And I'll tell you, this is mostly a mathematical construct, because you don't have enough people in either of those areas that actually commute into the Portland metro area to actually achieve emission reductions in the Portland area. But they get to count those people towards emission reduction simply because they tested them, even though it does not affect or help Portland's air. In the Senate version of the bill in 1993, Yamhill County and Columbia County were removed from the Senate version of the bill, and that's the bill that ultimately passed. And I think that was a clear legislative directive not to extend testing into those two counties. However, DEQ did it by rule in the interim between the 93 and the 95 session. During the 95 session, I worked with Representative Federici from Columbia County and Senator Dukes and Senator Bunn from my district. And we worked once again on this issue and came up with a comprehensive bill that included getting rid of gasoline-powered lawnmowers, which actually pollute more than the small amount of cars they were going to test in both Yamhill and Columbia counties. It included encouraging DEQ to get emission reduction credits for an education program. And what ultimately ended up happening is the governor did veto that bill, but that bill would have removed Yamhill and Columbia County from the testing. In the interim, between the 95 and 97 sessions, DEQ did greatly reduce the areas in Yamhill and Columbia counties that they were going to test, but they left a problem for our citizens. There are still citizens in both those areas that need to be tested. In Columbia County, they have to travel 30-some-odd miles round-trip. In my county, they have to travel 16 to 20 miles round-trip to get to the vehicle testing center. And you have many people in Yamhill County and Columbia County who do not commute into Portland, who are not affecting the Portland airshed. and they have to go up there to get tested. And this includes a lot of retirees. It includes, in my area, a lot of farm workers who live and work in Yamhill County who have no reason to go up to the Portland area except they have to get their car tested. And this is a hardship on those people. And so what we ask you to do in House Bill 2637 is to allow the folks who do not commute to the Portland metro area, who are not affecting the Portland metro area's air quality, are asking you to allow those people to be able to indicate when they get their license renewal for their vehicle that they do not commute. This is already done in my county because, unfortunately, even though they are only doing the testing on a very small portion of the county, the mailing goes out to everybody who lives in the city of Newburgh, which is a city of 16,000 people, and the entire city of Newburgh is exempt, but they all get this mailing. And there's a little check mark on the form to say, I don't live in the vehicle inspection area. And so you could simply add another spot on the form to say, I do not commute to the Portland metro area, and then have them indicate who their employer was or that they were retired. And that is simply what House Bill 2637 asks you to do. It really is a fairness issue. I will refine my calculation, but I made a rough calculation of what percent the people in Yamhill and Columbia counties actually, the percentage that they are considered as part of this entire ozone maintenance plan. And our two counties represent less than 0.25% of the entire plan. And I think to allow the 60-some-odd percent of our people who do not commute to just have this little check mark on their vehicle registration form makes eminent sense, and it is a fairness issue, and I would encourage you to help us pass House Bill 2637.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman Starr, and it's a pleasure to be here today. State Senator Gary Georgia, District 2, which includes Leslie's district, and then on down to the Central Oregon coast. And one of the major considerations I'd like to deal with, and I realize we're very short on time, and that is ground-level ozone and some things that are happening that may really make this bill very much common sense. And part of that is, I'll show you this right here. This was given to me by DEQ. And as you notice here, this is the amount of ground-level ozone that is being produced by small engines. Of course, this is automobile. And they're suggesting this could be taken out by the increased vehicle emission inspection. But there's a really interesting thing that's happening right now, the dynamics of clean automobiles. And since you're the only one left, Senator Starr, I'm going to talk to you. You may remember this, Starr, and this is the success rate and the failure rate on tenants' vehicle inspections. What we're finding right now is that because people in a good economy are able to buy newer cars, they're much more efficient. They have computers on board that deal with the pollution potential and adjust carburation or injection and able to deal with that. One of the interesting things, though, and we passed a bill recently encouraging the push towards the idea of the low sulfur fuel. We're probably going to have federal regulation coming real soon to do that nationwide. And also in the year 2002 to 2006, you're going to be seeing the first of the new low sulfur cars. And what you'll find out if we go to low sulfur or with those vehicles being on the road, is that about 50% of the whole chart disappears. First of all, the low sulfur fuel will affect the small engine usage, and of course, all of the automobile level will just almost disappear completely. So what we're suggesting is it's very reasonable, since we have attainment. One of the things, the notation on this chart was that in 1970, we were 50% over the standard. We're no longer over the standard. We're substantially below it. One thing that bothered us a little bit is the folks, as Leslie said, 0.25% effect that we are having in Portland, is the fact that they're looking for our clean air base to mix with the dirtier air base for the reason that it then allows them to expand some industrial emissions. I don't think that's fair. They need to deal with their pollution problems. We'll deal with ours. This is very reasonable from the standpoint that changes are coming that may, in fact, make vehicle testing either minimalized or eliminated in the future because of the new efficient automobiles that are on the way.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Senator.
That was a closed public hearing, and we're closing the Committee on Rules and Elections. Thank you all for your kind attendance. seem to be spinning our wheels.